but it is the law. The moral principles that, you know, should guide our lawmaking and the decision of the judiciary should, you know, they should make a good law in the first place. But once it's written and this explicit, it's our job simply to apply it. And not to mention that the intent to revoke is not the same as actually revoking his will. So, you know, we reading intent into this is not, it's too strong a role for the judge in this particular case. I should also say he was punished for murder. So he was punished for murder, but the question is, should he still get the inheritance after serving his jail time?
So I just have one question about the facts of the case, and I'm curious about, so this list of enumerated, I say maybe annulment conditions.
Yeah.
This seems really important to me. And my question is, you say that it is part of a statute. I wonder what that means specifically, if that has to do with the way that wills are written generally, or whether that case was omitted when the will itself was written, because I know that a will is a contract, or it has right. some kind of, it's a legal document. So you could include annulling conditions in it. If that list is contained in the will itself, that seems to express the will of I'm forgetting his name.
Of Francis Palmer, I believe.
Of Francis Palmer.
Yeah. No, good question. So okay, so the idea is that in the statute that talks about wills generally, it is enumerated the list of conditions that would result in the annulment. So basically, yes, you could add further conditions, you know, in your will saying that, you know, specifying certain things. But so they're called hereinafter cases. So as for an example, so the hereinafter cases that a will should be revoked say, when there is some other will in writing or some other writing of the testator declaring such revocation or alteration and executed with the same formalities with which the will itself was required by law to be executed. So, for example, you actually write a new will, go to the court, get it passed, you know, and make sure that it's all the boxes are checked, and you change your will. That's a way to revoke an old will. Or if you leave behind a wife and children who haven't been provided for in your will, unless the will shows an intention not to make such a provision, you know, then it would go to the wife and children, because the it's written in the statute. This is a principle that they say, okay, if you don't leave anything for your family, we're going to give something to your family if you don't specify that we shouldn't, right? So, and so on. So there's six of these. And so there's nothing in there and nothing in the will that says, in case I am murdered, don't give this to my murderer. So
let me respond by posing a slightly different question. Let's make it even simpler, a hypothetical case here. Supposing I was the stood to inherit a lot of money from the death of my father. And I really wanted that money sooner rather than later. And I decided that, you know what, I think I'm going to kill my father and accept the consequences of, you know, the criminal punishment for killing him, because I'm going to get the money sooner. So I'm going to make a calculated decision to kill him, do my best in court to minimize the sentence. Maybe I'll get out of jail in 20, 30 years, but I'll be very, very rich a lot sooner. And so I kill my father. So there's no question of intent or reading into the will. It's simply what the will says. I get the money. I inherit the money from my father, and I made a conscious decision to kill him to get the money sooner. So should that stand? Should I get the money?
So that is exactly
and the punishment.
Yeah, that is exactly this case. That is exactly what happens in Rigg versus Palmer.
Well, it's not exact, because in Riggs versus Palmer, there's some evidence that the will, there was some intent or inclination to change the
right. Will, right. Okay. So you're right. Yeah, there is that element that's different. So there is a sense in which the grandfather might have changed the will
not to, you know, and that that might have resulted in Elmer not receiving it, and that's part of the reason he also committed it. So that's fair enough. But for, you know, in all other aspects, it's a very similar case. And I think if you're going to ask me, that this is why I stand with the positivists on this. And the reason I say that is because the law has six very specific, explicit, enumerated cases where the will can be revoked. And I'm totally in agreement with you that that's a bad law. They should have thought about the fact that someone should be murdered, or that should someone be murdered, that this wouldn't, that, you know, the murderer would be able to profit from their own crime. Now, this may be simplifying it. I will grant that the natural law theorist can see something like, you really think that no one thought of that in a room of 130, you know, members of parliament, or however many there were at the time. You know, they really think that not one of those people put their hand up and said, what about, you know, someone murdering someone to get the will? And it's possible that they just thought that was a principle implicit there, that no one should be able to benefit from their own crime, and they didn't bother to write it down. But we don't know that, right? Maybe it was just omitted, and then in that case we should change the law, but it's not the judge's job to do it in that case, in that right. time, by their discretion.
Right. But Mihai, but when I raised the example, I wasn't meaning to suggest that I was taking that position that the inheritance should be forfeited. I was just raising that question. There's a couple of problems that I can think of right off the bat with causing an inheritance or to be forfeited or nullifying what the will says. And one of them is right in the opinion given in this judgment. It says, but to concede appellant's views would involve the imposition of an additional punishment or penalty upon the respondent. What power or warrant have the courts to add to the respondent's penalties by depriving him of property? The law has punished him for his crime, and we may not say that it was an insufficient punishment. So yeah. That's one of the problems is why should the courts impose a second punishment upon the guilty party? So he's already been punished. He's already paid for his crime, presumably, right? When he was...
Yeah, he was in prison. Yeah.
Right. So why should society or the courts impose an additional penalty on him by substituting? And then another problem is there. It's only speculation what the deceased decedent would have done. Why should the courts substitute their opinion for what the decedent specifically wrote in his will?
Right.
We don't know that the decedent would have changed his will or would have denied the inheritance, even if he knew, or she or whoever knew, that person was going to kill him or her. Maybe the person doesn't care. I don't know.
Right.
Who is it for the courts to second guess that?
Brian, I want to toss it to you if you do have something to say here before I jump back in.
Yeah, I mean, my wonder about this is because the cause of the murder is because of the will. Like, this is explicitly in order to get this. Now, if they're punished for murder, I would assume that some kind of motivation would have been taken into account for prosecuting that specific crime. So if that's already accounted for, if the motivation for it is already accounted for in the charge of the murder, there really, it seems like the case has already been addressed legally, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is the dissenting case, right? And that is a compelling case. I will play the devil's advocate here. I agree with you, but I'll play the devil's advocate and I say, okay, so this is what the majority says, is that there are some principles that underlie the law that, even though they are not expressed in any statute, they have actually been acted on in the common law system. So again, one of these may be no one is a judge in their own case, or all sides must be heard for a trial to be fair, or something like that. Like if you said, there's actually another case where this happens in Canada, where usually it goes from a trial court to a court of appeal, and then the Supreme Court of Canada. There's a hierarchy, right? And there's one case called the Skokie case. I won't get into it, but basically the Supreme Court took it right from trial court up to the Supreme Court and skipped the appeal court step. And that you may say that's not hearing all the sides in this case, right? And there's big fuss about that. So there's some principles that, though they're not written down, we adhere to. And one of them may well be no one should profit from their own crime. And so when you are considering the judgments of people and you're imposing punishments and stuff, you don't allow people to benefit from the ill-gotten gains of their crimes. And that's just something that we do. That's a principle of the law, despite not being written down anywhere. So that would be an argument on the other side of the case.
And I am quite, I guess, compelled by the principled argument.
Right.
I mean, I ultimately do think that some kind of account needs to be taken for the particular motivation having a profit. I mean, there are all kinds of motivations for murder. Some of them are acquired in the act itself. Some are, you know, a means to an end. And I think that needs to be taken into account. Presiding over this, so I'm not pressured to figure out this, but that is one thing that I would be compelled to do, is to take into account that there is something kind of there is a profit to be made out of this, and that is a salient detail. It's not just something that is accounted for in, you know, the enumeration clauses or whatever,
right,
or already accounted for in the case. It just means your case is more complicated and you have more work to do.
Yeah, exactly. And really what this gets down to, and I want to get to another case here while we still have the time, and we'll sort of see these play again against each other, but it's really a question of what is the court's job? What is a judge's role? And, you know, maybe I'll make this into even a longer than a two-episode series, because it'd be really interesting to talk a bit about the role of the judiciary and what your job is as a judge. Because someone might say, okay, our job, we're as my prof called lawyers, intellectual plumbers. And the judge might be like, I don't know, an intellectual bookkeeper almost, where you say, this is the law. Someone comes before us. Is it written in the law? Did they break it? Did they not? It's a machine. You chug things through. But some would say, no, I mean, a judge is there to judge. That is, to apply discretion and interpretation to make sure that cases come out in a way that furthers justice and that benefits people beyond just what the law says explicitly. So it's that balancing act.
Well, this issue not only comes up with judges, but also with juries.
Right.
So juries can nullify laws as a practical matter. In Canada, the court, the judges aren't supposed to tell the jury they can do that, but the jury can. So juries can and have find a defendant not guilty, even though they would admit that the defendant violated the letter of the law. Perhaps the jury considers the law to be unjust or immoral. They can find the defendant not guilty on that basis.
So let's go to another case while we still have time here. And I want to pitch these again against each other and see what you think. Which one do we want to do? Let's talk about Dudley and Stevens. This one is interesting. So, okay, in The Crown versus Dudley and Stevens, basically what happened is the following. So this was a case from 1884, a few years prior. And so there's an English yacht, a super yacht that, you know, Elon Musk would ride. I mean, like, a sailing vessel that is traveling to Australia. And on this vessel are these gentlemen, Dudley, Stevens, Brooks, and Parker, who are, so Parker is a 17-year-old. He's, deckhand. He's maybe looking for adventure or whatever. He's there with everyone else. And they get in a storm. And to escape the storm, the ship is going down. They get on a lifeboat and they sail off. And the ship sinks a few minutes later. So clearly a good decision. The only thing they have with them is two cans of turnips and no fresh water. And they end up at sea for 24 days. Four men with two cans of turnips, 24 days at sea. So the food runs out by day 12. So they eat a can of turnips. Then later on, I think they catch a turtle and they eat that. And then they eat the last can of turnips, a couple weeks in. And then people start getting sick. So Parker, the boy, is, I think, sort of slipping in and out of consciousness here. He's quite weak, and some of the others are as well. And one of them, Dudley, suggests that they draw straws for someone to die in order to feed the rest of the other three, until they can until they can be saved. Brooks says no. He refuses to do that the first time around. Then, a few days later, it's suggested again, and I believe Parker is then held down by Stevens by Dudley while Stevens slits his throat, something like that. Brooks is not involved in the killing, but he does partake of, the resulting nourishment with the others. So the question is, and then a few days later, they get saved. Dudley and Stevens are tried for murder. Cannibalism is not actually a crime, much like it's not in Canada at the moment either, but they are tried for the murder charge. Brooks is not, because he didn't participate in the killing. And so the question is this case of extreme necessity enough to justify the murder? Or should they still be charged to the full extent, which would be capital punishment, on murder charges? And the result of the case, I want the two of you to sort of, I want to hear your thoughts on this before I talk about what the judges said. But the result is that they were charged, but the charge was reduced. So they spent 6 months in jail and then were released. They did not take the capital punishment. So, that's the discussion. Again, should they have been charged and to the full extent? For murder, is there a difference in this case because of necessity, which is what the defense is arguing?
That could be framed as a utilitarian versus deontological moral debate, too. Killing one person provided sustenance for the rest, which produced maximum overall happiness. If they didn't kill anybody, everyone would have probably, well, they didn't know it at the time. They were about to be rescued, but they might have all died of starvation. So at least... there is overall a higher score of happiness by killing one person, but it would violate Kantian ethics to kill somebody for any reason.
Yeah. And I should qualify as well. They had some navigational instruments, and they knew that they were like hundreds of miles from shore. Like there was, unless they were saved by a ship, which they didn't know was coming, they had no chance of actually returning to shore before they all perished. So I'll add that in just in case, that changes anything. Brandon, I want to hear what you think about this.
Yeah. I mean, this is a difficult case specifically. I mean, because the thing that makes this really difficult is that you have a kind of extenuating circumstance that blankets the whole thing. Because obviously someone was killed. I don't know what this adds, but because it more or less just is the problem of the case. There is a certain, like, maybe the question is, what is the nature of the compulsion here? There's a certain kind of physical necessity that makes this reasonable, makes it legally permissible. Because the question is not, okay, like, they killed someone, we're going to charge them for that. Are we going to also charge them for cannibalism? That's not the question is, okay, well, is what they did murder? Like, they obviously didn't want to do this. People dissented to even consensually being killed to feed the others. People don't want to die here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a certain kind of necessity. Does that change the motivation? Does it change does it change what a reasonable person would do in that circumstance?
Yeah, right. Well, you're basically hitting the nail on the head. So on the prosecution side, what they basically say that is that there is no common law precedent for either necessity nor insanity being sufficient defenses for murder. So it's never been ruled that either necessity or mental unfitness is enough to is a good defense, is a sufficient defense for murder. In addition, the only permissible sort of defense here would be self-defense, but Parker was almost comatose. He was not attacking anyone, clearly. So this is the prosecution argument, is that basically, therefore, it's murder. There's no permission for it. Now, the defense, they are saying, well, actually, this case of extreme necessity does, you know, preclude punishment for them. Like, this is, you know, it's justified because of necessity. And so you get this question of, like, first of all, is there a relevant analogy between murder and necessity, murder and self-defense? And another thing, I'll throw a wrench into this, murder and omission of giving aid. Because they chose to kill Parker in order to get this to feed themselves. What if they had just refused to feed him with the food that they had between them and allowed him to die and then partaken? Now, they may not have made it to that point, but does that again make it a different story? Some would say maybe, right? But again, here's that natural law positivist distinction. It's like, okay, letter of the law, there's nothing saying that there's nothing in the law that says that this is permissible, right? So we flipped the script here. This time it's the proposition that's taking the prosecution that's taking the positivist view, where it's like, there's nothing saying that this is permissible, right? And the defense is saying, no, this necessity principle, this, you know, moral, let's say, this need to preserve oneself is going to overshadow the charge of murder, right? That's kind of the argument here. And I would say one thing. I'm curious what you think about this. I almost see it as, like, if someone has a right to life, then their biggest grievance was forfeiting someone else's right to life in order to preserve their own. So even if they have their own right to life, they can't take someone else's in order to just to supplement that. So I wonder what you think of that claim. And of course, I'm with the prosecution here, but I'm curious what you think.
There was an incident, I remember watching a movie of it in high school, I think it was, of a plane landing or a crash landing in the Andes.
Right.
And the people did cannibalize some of them. Now, I would be interested to put these two cases side by side and wonder, okay, what is the nature of the compulsion to eat another human here? Because in the one case, at least the way it was portrayed, so it might be completely different, but this is all we can go off of. It was, okay, like, I'm going to die. Don't feel bad. You know, go ahead and eat me. No one compelled the others to die. But it's interesting, this case or this instance that you bring up of omission to guilt, where, okay, as soon as they get it in the head of another person, oh, once people die, I'll have something to eat, you know, as soon as you kind of plant that seed in their minds and they just don't do anything, once that person dies and you start eating on them, does that change what they've done? Did they let them die? That is, murder them? I mean, it seems like they couldn't have done anything to prevent anyone dying. It's significant that they did kill someone.
Yeah, though. Exactly. And that's the big distinction. You're talking about the Netflix movie they made off of that is Society of the Snow, right?
It might have been Netflix. This is a while ago.
Yeah, but I know what you're talking about, though. So the soccer team that crash landed in the Andes Mountains, right? And that's exactly the distinction, right? Is that they were not given permission, consent to do this, nor did they simply wait for someone to sort of die of whatever causes. They did resort to the actual killing in order to do this. And the important thing to note here is that one of the justices, Justice Coleridge, writing, said that there's no... So a total divorce of law and morality would have, quote, fatal consequences. So he's saying it's not that there's no connection between law and morality. We want good laws. But legal is not the same as moral. And there is simply no defense for killing someone in these circumstances, even if it was the moral thing to do to, let's say, preserve the other three.
Let me suggest one other nuanced approach to this, which is to back up a step and ask, well, what's the purpose of applying the criminal justice system at all to this situation. So this was a tragic situation that happened on a boat. Why do we need to do anything? So one might argue, well, we need to implement retributive justice, right? So there needs to be retribution for a crime. So if that's the motivation, then we could make a strong argument that really there shouldn't be retribution because the need was so strong. And in that situation, if any situation excuses murder, perhaps that is that situation, because this was a matter of desperation and survival. So maybe retributive justice is not appropriate here. Another way to look at the application of justice would be for the purpose of deterrence. Do we need to deter people from doing this in a similar situation? Is this situation so common that there has to be a deterrence from people eating other people on boats, which are stranded out in the middle of nowhere with two cans of sardines? One could argue that it's such a rare occurrence that deterrence isn't really necessary. So perhaps one could argue that under either of those criteria, retribution or deterrence, it's not appropriate to punish the people who ate the other person.
Right. So that's very modern concepts that I don't think they perhaps were considering in as technical or theoretical a detail back then. You know, I may be wrong about that, but definitely we have a few episodes to go. Talk about, I still have another case under my belt I want to talk about, and I haven't mentioned Dworkin at all. So who kind of presents a quasi compromise view of the two, though he is mostly on the positivist side. He's actually a student of Hart. He says, okay, well, Hart was right about a lot, but there's still some essential aspect of moral principles here at play that you can't get away from, no matter how much of a positivist you are. So some discussion to come, but thank you very much for joining me on this intro, and I look forward to having some more discussion on it at a future date. And this is once again, the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find us at tcps.podbean.com. I've been Mihai Kovacevic here with Michael Robert Kaditz and Brandon Brownlee. I'll see you next time.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Join the SFU SOCA, Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry, all throughout February for events in celebration of Black History Month. On February 1st, at the sub-social stage, from 3 to 5 p.m., is the kickoff ceremony with a focus theme of African Americans and the arts. On February 9th, games and movie night in the SOCA room in the Student Union Building, room 1430, on the first floor, from 6 to 10 p.m. February 16th, get your groove on with a dance workshop held in subroom 2410, second floor of the Student Union Building, from 6 to 8 p.m. And finally, February 24th, support SOCA in recognition of 30 years with a gala event held in the sub ballroom, fifth floor of the Student Union Building, from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. For more information, visit the SOCA Instagram at SFUSOCA or drop by their space in the Student Union Building, room 1430.